The latest full episode of The Weekly Take presents a 360-degree look at real estate investing and the capital markets from the perspectives of a pair of influential executives, each with decades of experience in the debt capital markets business. We welcomed our own Tom Rugg, Vice Chairman and Co-Head of U.S. Large Loans in Debt and Structured Finance at CBRE.
Great to be here.
He joined us alongside Bob Ritchie, Senior Managing Director of Lone Star Funds, a player with nearly $90 billion of assets across nearly two dozen funds in its portfolio.
Great to be here. Thank you.
We also welcomed some special listeners into our session, a group of CBRE summer interns who had some terrific questions to ask our guests. On this special edition of The Weekly Take, we keep the conversation going as I pose some of the insightful questions submitted by the young talent in the room. I'm Spencer Levy, and that's right now on this extra take of The Weekly Take. So we have a couple of questions here from our audience. And by the way, thank you to our audience. You thought I was ignoring you. I was not ignoring you. And so the audience questions are the following. Number one, quote, I saw some skyscrapers in St. Louis are being sold for just a few million dollars. Is it possible for this city to recover, or will these buildings just be left empty? Any point of view?
So I do have some familiarity with St. Louis. I went to grad school there in the mid-90s at Washington University in St. Louis. I think the struggles of St. Louis are much more unique than they are to the rest of the office sector, meaning the city of St. Louis has been depopulating in people and businesses for the last 50 years, right? And we're seeing a continuation, the final vestiges of that. So what happens? The old Boatman's Bank building and others that were single tenant, these large banks that were there, they're gone. Their acquirers, Bank of America, they're long gone. And there's no one to fill the void. However, if you go to the west end or the western suburbs of St. Louis, right, where you go to Frontenac or Ladue or, you know, many of these other markets, they're actually thriving, right? So it's not so much the city, it's shifted in location. Why? Because people don't want to live in the western suburbs and then have the drive in and drive back. Developers just started developing right in their own neighborhoods, and they've got terrific office buildings and neighborhoods. So I think those challenges, while there's some similarity, they've been at work in St. Louis a long time, and many of those companies don't exist. It's a long secular trend that's been going on for decades.
I mean, COVID really accelerated a shift in demographic trends. And that trend was away from certain Midwestern cities. You know, I can't speak to St. Louis as much, but other major MSAs like Chicago, into the Sun Belt cities and into Florida and Texas and in the Southwest. Why did that shift occur? Certain tax advantages, affordability issues, safety issues, sort of a myriad of issues. I think the real question and why they traded for several million dollars is their demand to fill those office towers. And secondly, office assets require significant capital. They require CapEx, deferred maintenance, tenant improvements, leasing commissions. That requires the new owner to contribute an awful lot of capital into restabilizing these assets. And so that would also explain why some of these assets in cities like St. Louis are trading at such steep or deep discounts.
And I should mention the submarket that's probably most attractive there is Clayton, Missouri. That's a killer little suburb. It's almost a little mini city by itself now.
Well, on the flip side of a city that gets negative headlines, though, you did point out some bright spots in St. Louis. We talked about the Smile States or the Sun Belt. What makes that attractive as an investment opportunity?
Educated workforce, affordable housing, affordable living conditions, safety, university presence, a growing diversity in terms of its economic makeup. These are all attractive for companies, for investment, for families, that folks that want to raise their families. All of this is contributing to growth in these types of markets, and it's growth that's coming from places like we talked about, life sciences. Sectors like life sciences are pushing into markets like Raleigh, where there's educated workforce and a lot of university presence.
We own over 20,000 multifamily units across the Sun Belt. I'd also add to that, there's a certain welcoming to business in those states. What does that mean? There's a reasonable tax arrangement. It's not overly burdensome. The regulatory environment is balanced to favorable. You can do things without a lot of governmental headwind. Where that exists, capital will go because it can be deployed more freely. Where it doesn't exist, capital will go, but it's just more difficult, right? So at any point, the returns have to be more attractive to compel it to go there than to go where you don't have that. And I think the Sun Belt states have largely been getting that right. Now, you do get more supply of that, but I think that people talk a lot about the supply in the Sun Belt, multifamily and whatnot. The other part of it is, what about the job creation and the absorption? It's nearly keeping up with generational supply increases. So I think an undertold story is that, yes, you do have this enormous wave of supply, but they're not sitting empty, right? They're getting absorbed. There'll be some period where they catch up, but it's been an enormous engine of job growth as well.
One specific question, very small question, and then we'll end it. But the specific question that came up is, what is Tier 1 capital and why does it matter?
The easiest way to think about it is common equity of a bank. Plain and simple, what you have is common equity. There are many forms of equity. Just keep it simple, common equity. Most U.S. banks now are capitalized to the tune of plus or minus 10% common equity. So if you have a $100 bank with $10 of common equity, if you're at 300% commercial real estate to your common equity, it means you have $30 of commercial real estate versus your $10 of common equity. That's uncomfortable because if you're $30 in commercial real estate, just takes a 5% hit, right? That's 60% of your capital base has been shredded. That means it's lights out. That's why the regulators don't like it. Right, there's a certain lumpiness of risk of commercial real estate that's unlike any other asset sector that's on a bank's balance sheet, as opposed to autos, auto loans, or credit card loans, or even mortgage loans that are statistically much more homogeneous, and the loss profiles tend to be very narrow and predictable. Commercial real estate, I mean, they can vary, right? A garment district empty office building could be a 90% wipe. This property right here will be money good probably forever, right? Right. So it's that lumpiness that the regulators really nervous.
Bob Ritchie, Senior Managing Director of Lone Star Funds. Thank you for coming out.
Spencer, thank you very much. And thank you, everyone.
Tom Rugg, Vice Chairman, Co-Head of U.S. Large Loans. Tom, thanks for coming out. Great job.
Thanks again, Spencer.
And I want to give a special shout out to our New York City interns. Thank you for being great listeners, putting in great questions, and rock on. We hope you enjoyed this extra round of insights about real estate funds. And if by chance you missed this week's main episode that digs deeper into the topic, you can find it at our homepage, cbre.com/theweeklytake. It's also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any platform that you like to use. We'll be back after the July 4th celebration in America and look forward to seeing you then as we talk to the brightest stars in the world of commercial real estate across the U.S. and beyond. For now, I'm Spencer Levy. Be smart, be safe, be well, enjoy the holiday.